Yes. I guess I'm hearing this partly through the lens of a forum I went to yesterday on youth at risk. And they were talking about foster children, abused children, children in the probation system. And over again, the question arose about how do we treat children not just as individuals, but as part of community. So I'm kind of wondering how this, how what you have said fits into the question of individualism and community. Because certainly the consensus of the group was there was an emerging awareness that you can't just treat one and one, you have to find ways to fit them into a system. So,
you see, when a culture is going through a whole system shift, and I think we are, a shift in health, a shift in education, a shift in politics, a shift in economics, a shift in environment and energy, what you find is every single existing structure is inadequate. All of them, simultaneously. So it really looks overwhelming. And you think you need to go in, I'm going to fix this one, I'm going to fix that one, I'm going to fix the other one. So the first thing you need to do is say, all right, all systems are breaking down, and all systems are also breaking through. And that there are innovations and creative solutions to precisely that problem, if we take that one, somewhere in the system. Somewhere foster children have been handled properly and lovingly and there's community around them. Let's just take that as an example. What I feel in the social gospel that is required for conscious evolution is scanning for, mapping, connecting, and communicating what's already working. Then applying what's emergent and created to the existing problem. Because there's a tendency to be so problem-oriented and crisis-oriented that we don't even notice that everywhere somebody has solved it somehow. And I happened to have run for the Vice Presidency of the United States in 1984. And I had this very wonderful idea that the Vice President should be in charge of finding out what's working in America. Between a vice president who would be mapping, scanning, and connecting it, and encouraging what's working, and then have what's working dealing with what's not working, rather than the other way around, can you imagine the skill of our internet system and our research system applied to that? And I just want to tell you one thing that has come up recently. I have a friend who's head of the American Council of the United Nations University Millennium Project, and they're working on all the global challenges, of which children are a big, big part of it. So they have 90 nodal points of scholars and leaders all around the world in every culture responding to the challenges. And I said to Jerry the other day, what if you asked these 90 nodal points, all connected via computer, what's working in Tehran? What's working in Palestine? What's working in Africa? And he said, wow, what a good idea. And it's amazing. And you know, we're involved in a project that may be trying to make that happen. But we have to raise the funds to get the United Nations to do this. It seems so obvious to me. And also, if I could possibly get to one of the presidential candidates and say, how about saying your vice president is going to be in charge of nurturing the creativity of our country? See, so I wanted to get back to the question. The systems breakdown is hard to repair in just in tiny pieces. So you have to start seeing where it's working. And then learning from where it's working. There's something on the internet called New Horizons for Learning that was put together by Dee Dickinson. Dee Dickinson has been working for 15 years to identify every educational process that is creating a whole person from every level. You look at New Horizons for Learning, I bet you'll see something on education of children at risk, foster children, and then you start using that. And that's the new social systems, the way they're going to be built. and they all have a different value system of synergy, cooperation, love, all of them. Yeah, Cindy.
Barbara, you know, I picked up on the internet the Delancey Foundation.
Yeah.
And the success that they've had with drug and alcohol abuse and all kinds of crimes. And it was amazing. Their success rate was really high.
The Lancy Foundation in the San Francisco area, I went there for lunch, and they deal with people who, it's their last resort before being in prison forever. They've been in prison, they're drug addicts mainly, and criminals, and they have a system right in there, and I went to lunch there, and everybody who's serving you was a drug addict. Mm. It's an amazing culture, and it was very, very well done. And I say, what's the principle that works here? And here's the principle. When somebody comes in, it's all entrepreneurial, they don't take government money. When somebody comes in off the street with all these problems, they learn something like a printing press. The minute they learn it, they teach it to the new one just coming in. It's each one teach one. And just by getting a skill, and being the one to help somebody else in a benign way shift, and they actually have made a huge entrepreneurial success out of it. Mm-hmm. So there's the idea here is to scan the whole system for projects like Delancey Street. Yes.
Reading and rereading the beginning of this chapter leaves me with a problem of her approach to evil. Essentially, what I got out of her approach was at least what this one sentence. Again, I am not saying that everyone who has suffered loss will engage in evil, but that someone who commits evil will probably be found to be someone who has suffered loss. Now, that appears to me to be standard blaming of an environment for our acts.
Well, I think what
basic Freudian psychology, and based on that, approach to where evil comes from is no more satisfactory than anything else I've read on it.
No, I think what she's saying that most acts of evil come from somebody having felt a loss of self-esteem, that the solving of the problem is not punishment or blame, it's unconditional love. So if you want to deal with somebody who is doing that, or someone who's in prison, or someone who's doing this, you have to just realize immediately their local egoic self was in charge of that act. So that doesn't mean he's not responsible, but it's his local self, his egoic self, the deeper self of that person. This is the faith. If the God self were in charge, that person wouldn't do it. So your job in helping the sinner would be yourself to stay centered in your God self. Don't blame, don't punish, and see if you can love that person unconditionally enough, with enough education, so that you can actually change that person and that you can change people. No? He's doubting, he's doubting. Let's see.
I don't think that evil is emanating out of experience.
Oh, and do you believe, where do you think evil comes from?
I wish I knew. I haven't found anybody that can answer that. I can't, that's for sure.
You know, I'd like to give you a thought. This comes from Aurobindo, this Sri Aurobindo, the Eastern evolutionary genius. He pointed this out. I always thought it was true, that you don't say animals are evil is when they kill each other. Or even if they play with, you know, the cat will play with the mouse, or you don't say, oh, but an evil cat. Because there isn't that moral judgment in the animals. He never called them evil. He says the price evolution paid for individuality was the egoic separation and the ability to hurt each other consciously. Animals hurt each other, but it's not the same thing. The price evolution paid for this whole period of Homo sapiens is we have developed separate, individual, egoic beings. And we can be judged guilty by ourselves for the misuse of it. But he believes, and I believe, that the next stage after egoic individualization is emergence as a divine human connected to source, but as an individual and not as a member of a tribe. In other words, evolution is producing divine individuality. And we had to go through a period of the illusion of separation to have an individual like ourselves who could then be able to make a free choice to shift identity. So that when you come through this, you become co-creator with the divine. And one reason this is so important, somebody came up to me just now and said, what about our being able to take animal genes and human genes and join them? What are we going to do? What are we going to do about stem cells, of cloning, of self-design, where we can actually change our own genetic code? What are we going to do with nanotechnology that can build like nature does? That can't be handled by the egoic separated consciousness. But since we've gained those powers, I think we're evolving into beings able to incarnate the divine. So I say, I can't judge the last hundreds of thousands of years of self-centered consciousness, but I'm assuming by faith it was needed. I'm assuming by faith it was needed that we went through a period of individuation, and I'm assuming by faith we're going through it, to be honest. That's a faith statement.
Well, I love your optimism, but the issue in hand is that anything you can do, you will do.
Yeah.
And I don't live to see it, but the cloning of human beings and the whole thing.
Well, I think that you really need to. I think you need to live a long time now and see if we can see it through together.
I just thought that I want to share. I've always been very perturbed and no longer by the part in Our Father, Lead Us Not Into Temptation. And that hit home very strongly when I hit one to me, and God gave us the ego.
Yes.
And it's part of our evolutionary process, our maturation process. Without it, we couldn't go from the childish person we are born to the childlike wise person that we are capable of becoming.
I totally agree.
And so, you know, ego is just part of free will, and God gave it.
That's exactly what I think. And God gave it to us and also gave us the opportunity to shift identity.
Exactly.
From that ego.
The potential we have.
And I think the story of Jesus is a pattern of how it is when you do that. That's why he founded his Western civilization here.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's no small thing, that's what founded all of this.
Exactly.
In other words, for all the mistakes that organized religion has made, there is a fundamental truth in there. That's the most precious truth. And I think the story of Jesus is coming true. Yes.
We've had a couple of, at least good examples of forgiveness in our lifetime, and one was John Paul II, who forgave his would-be assassin when he was in prison. He went to visit him and forgave him. And then the Amish people who forgave the murderers of their children, and that's so good to hear. You know, it reminds us all of the value of forgiveness, and that goodness diffuses itself.
It happens, and you know, in the South Africa situation with that truth and reconciliation, that was really one truth and reconciliation instead of punishment.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why the entire prison system doesn't go that direction.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
The whole bureaucracy of punishment needs to be transformed. That is true, and it's good because we have done it. Yes?
It's an industry, and people's lives and livelihoods depend on it, and so is the army, and so is the military-industrial complex.
Mm-hmm.
We got a lot of people's salaries and pensions at stake in that interest.
here's something to really look at. We're going through a radical shift of civilization. And it's coming about through pressure to change or die. For example, global warming. See, we try to ignore global warming. But it seems to be, it's true. And now Al Gore's movie is very, very popular. And there are scientists who, I read in the Santa Barbara News Press, somebody went through to say just exactly how much of Santa Barbara would be underwater. And just exactly how far it would go. So, I mean, this is like real to Santa Barbara. It's Santa Barbara. And I think that global warming, as just one of many things, the whole environmental crisis and the weapons of mass destruction, is leading us to absolutely shift our whole socio-economic system, which is based on continuous growth that affects our environment and that actually depletes that environment. We're being forced into new energy sources. We're being forced into recognizing it's one living planetary body. These are mystical realizations we're being forced into by the threat to our life support system. Here we're finding in Iraq and Israel that the two greatest military forces on earth cannot win. That is really important and good. Horrible as it is, as long as massive military power is your win, there will be no way that we won't do it. But if we actually can't win against insurgents, the whole system, can you see those generals and those soldiers, and they're going to be confounded by this. And it's a terrible thing to say, because I have a great feeling of the purpose of the United States of America. And it's not domination and control, it's liberation and creativity. We're going to have to go the other way as Americans. So my word for this is that we are a vast communion of pioneering souls. And wherever you are, you're going to have to invent something better. Because wherever you are, if you're in healthcare, if you're in education, if you're in politics, you know it's not fully working. So you're called to find life purpose. And this is something I didn't say in my talk about essence. The shift from ego to essence. Once you are identified with your own essence or true self, that self is created. That's the creator within you. And that self has a unique expression of creativity for every single person. And the greatest joy in my life is to have found a particular form of essential self-expression. So I could do it. And when you do it, you get rewarded by the doing of it. And this is from Abraham Maslow. You don't need so much status. If you're actually doing your life purpose or your vocation, you are rewarded in the act. And I don't know why I just got on that point, but the things that aren't working, you think of the people trapped in your system. Then we think of all the new innovations that are working, they're more attractive. And I think the next socio-political economic shift will be the identification of what's working, the connecting of it, and the communicating of it to attract the system forward rather than to have to kill each other to move forward. I don't think revolution will work anymore anyway. We've had it too many times, and you just get some other power on top. Yes.
I'm going to go back to the personal and not so much a question, but what occurred to me as you're talking about the shift from the egoic to the existential, I'm aware of an ancient practice of spiritual direction coming back. And what that is we're sitting with another person or person to notice the moments of grace in your life, in your everyday life. And to become grateful for the fact that it exists, and have seen a spiritual director sitting with people and seeing things, seeing God's action, and and the more we tend to just believe them, I find. And, you know, play a tape, we're destructive, but we don't have people over the
life. Whatever we put our attention on grows. We have a mass media that's putting our attention on all the things that we don't want to have grow. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an infantile nervous system of a planetary body, and it's got a dis-ease of dis-emphathitis. It's dead-on emphasis. It doesn't pick up right. But that's there, too. And sometimes when people say to me, well, I don't think humans will ever change, and look how bad we are. I said, do you mean yourself, too? Are you that bad? And usually, they're not. You see, there's an image that we have that's projected in our media that actually isn't exactly who we are. And I believe that keeping your attention on that essence and that doing that with others, gradually, metaphysically, what happens is that begins to be your normal state of consciousness. And then you become a radiant presence. You become a benign presence for others. Yes, sir. You, yes.
In this shift, in this change, one thing that I find in myself and a lot of other people is the fear. I don't want change.
Yeah.
Yeah, intellectually, I say, oh yeah, Barbara's got a good point. I don't want to do it. I've got hundreds of books on cassette tape. Now, the National Library Service is going to ship everything over to flash memory card. I'm going to be one. I know, intellectually, there's going to be some way to transfer.
Yeah.
But I don't want to change. Leave me alone. I just find it's a big obstacle. It's a fear. Mm-hmm. And maybe this is why Jesus is saying so often, don't be afraid.
That's a really good point, a very honest point. That's a really, really good point. How many people in this room fear change? You know, now, it's really interesting. I'm attracted to it. I'm innately attracted to, now not just any old change, but that's an interesting characteristic. I change in myself. Say that again, Cindy.
I think the, and partly the fear of change itself, and too much change in this culture.
See, I feel that myself has unused potential. That everybody's self is not fully expressed yet. And that whenever I can find another expression of it that is of service and good, I'm rewarded more than by staying the same. Now that's my nature. You know, maybe that's not everybody's nature, but I can tell you, since change is inevitable, it would be worthwhile having a nature like that, because you're going to enjoy your life a lot more. If you're attracted, and when I say change, if you're attracted, it's another way of putting it, to the expression of your own potential. You know, I think it was Aristotle who said that the nature of all life is to realize its potential, whether it be a worm or a bird or anything. So the nature of the human is to realize our potential. If we did not live in a period of change, it would be harder to expand your potential. And the fact is, everybody in this room is alive in a period of radical change. And we're not going to change that. So let's look and see what that change can give to each of us that expands our joy, that expands our fulfillment. Because if you look for it, you'll find it. And fear can be a thing that blocks you finding it.
What about grumpy old men?
We just love them.
Well, I think for me,
is sort of whether you view the world as the future as being abundant or scarcity. And so if you see change as going for scarcity, I'm going to lose something and there's not enough for everybody, so I'm going to keep mine, then you fear it.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you feel like there's just tons out there and enough for everybody, if we figure out how to do it, then you're less fearful.
That is a very good point. If you are afraid that there's not enough, and that's also the ego fear. If we can design systems that are win-win, high synergy system where when one wins, the other wins a little bit more, instead of a highly competitive system like we have, then you don't fear change because you know that you will benefit from it. But if the system is structured so you don't benefit from it, then the ego itself crops up and is afraid. Because the ego itself is not only evil and destructive, it's fearful. It's probably more fearful than it is destructive. So how do you change that? It's only by creating more abundance in your own life, spiritually, socially, through love. And I do want to say something here on a global scale. The current understanding in physics is that the quantum vacuum is full. The current understanding in physics is that the so-called empty space of the universe is a quantum plenum, and it's called zero point energy. And there is within that apparent vacuum, at zero point energy, with absolutely no thermal energy whatsoever, there is vast, infinite sources of energy. I've just been reading a paper by Mark Cummings, and he calls it the quantum plenum. And there are some theoretical physicists who are identifying this and who even say it's possible to tap into that source of energy. And that when the human species is ready for it, we won't be dependent on fossil fuels or even renewable energy like solar and wind and so forth, that we will be tapping into the quantum plenum. And that the universe is designed for radical abundance. Radical abundance. And I've also always loved the space program. I've loved the, I know quite a few space scientists and astronauts who say that when we settle the solar system, there are materials of almost 1,000 Earths out there in the moon, Mars, the asteroids. There is in solar energy 24 hours a day that can be beamed to Earth, and that we are about to become a solar system species. But actually, on the big scale right now, we're caught in an economic system of scarcity and disequality. Some of us believe that the challenge of global warming and the challenge of war not working is eventually going to move the system towards social cooperation and tapping in to renewable resources and eventually unlimited resources of the solar system, of zero point energy and beyond. And I would like to hold that we're moving towards the story of the loaves and the fishes. I really believe we are. That's the direction, yes.
Well, I want you to back up on this. You know, everybody knows our prison system is really bad. And we're just warehousing people, and we spend so little on rehab. In other words, we put people in at young ages, and we don't even try to do anything in rehab. Let's just say you made it as vice president. I didn't vote for you. I wish I could. But we should have a plan or some ideas on this.
Oh, absolutely. I would have so many ideas. But among them, I would be really looking at the basic structure of truth and reconciliation process, wherever it has been working. And I would get the experts who have been doing that, and my goal would be, first of all, I mean, I'll tell you one story about this. I once was invited to speak to a group of prison wardens, including some of the leading prison wardens of the country. And the friend that invited me wanted me to tell this whole story of the evolution of our species. The woman was running the thing. She said, "Why in the world did you invite Barbara? What does this have to do with prison?" And so anyway, I got through it, and I asked them in some way to tell me what they thought was not working in the prison system and what they thought would work. And first of all, they finally became friendly enough. They said, actually, nothing is working. The prison system is broken. And our social systems are also broken because they don't cooperate at the social level before kids get to prison. They don't cooperate so that you don't have a social system that supports people in never getting to prison. That's number one. You have to have some kind of community support for people. And then number two, within the prison, instead of it being punishment out of evil doing, it would be even deeper than rehab. It would be a reconstruction of their lives. It would be truth and reconciliation. It would be getting the victims together with the people who committed the crime and have the criminals begin to do restitution and work in the community. And it would be an entirely different system. And it does happen, though, in some places. That's where I keep saying we have to see what works. I'm not an expert on prison systems, but after that discussion with the wardens, I said, since it doesn't work at all, what are you going to do about this? You're hesitant. And they basically said nothing. Yeah, because they have to go to the Attorney General, they have to risk their job, they have to upset all the apple carts of all the jobs. So they totally knew, and they weren't going to do anything.
This might be a good sign to fight my reconciliation and restore the justice to answer that question.
Please speak to how the sacrament of penance and reconciliation interacts with this chapter. I think very directly. Because in order to shift from your egoic behavior to your own divine self, there has to be a recognition that you don't want to continue with that behavior. You have to say, I no longer will put up with myself behaving this way. And to do penance for that and reconciliation for that without accepting the load of guilt forever, I mean, that's the important thing. But I, as I understand, confession is forgiveness. So you have to acknowledge what you did first. And then there needs to be forgiveness, and I think not only from the priest, but from your own essential self. Because self-judgment and self-incrimination is more strong for most of us than we're being condemned from outside.
You're absolutely right. And I think the problem with the sacrament of reconciliation is that all this power is for forgiving and reconciling is placed in the hands of a limited few. And I think initially the sacrament itself was instituted to highlight or encapsulate this more universal aspect of our evolution, and that's forgiveness and reconciliation. But we froze it in the hands of a few, and we weren't able to open it up to say that it's the responsibility of all of us to forgive and reconcile, and not just, and it doesn't just happen in this one place, but this is the place where we started. But it, you know, eventually, if the whole world learns how to forgive and be reconciled, you don't need the sacrament of reconciliation to be more than reconciled. You know what I mean? But in our church, I don't think we've enlarged it enough. It's still, you have to have it done by a priest.
Yes.
We're
really talking about the maturation of our species here. We needed the church, we needed the police force, we needed the president, the pope, and the professor. But what's happening now is we're internalizing the authority. If we're really growing up, if we're maturing, more and more of us are internalizing the authority and taking responsibility. Just like Beatrice says, you choose from choice freedom, you move from choice freedom to creative freedom. I'm the author. And who's that author in me? It's my divine self. That's the maturation of our species right there. Once that happens, the entire hierarchy of authority is not needed. And I've often thought that the evolution of democracy itself and self-governance depends on us being self-governing. Mm-hmm. Capital S. Yes, Alex.
You've already spoken to this before, but it's kind of rare in mind. Thought came to me, but the role of women in this evolutionary process, I think it was Brian Swim that I heard say what is actually, and I would say the role of the feminine more than saying the role of women, but it would be most personified in women. But what's driving the underlying issue of women's reproductive rights is that somewhere deep down, women know that the survival of the species is not going to be just in putting out more species. It's going to take a greater leap. And so this is where, not at a conscious level, but what's driving this is this understanding that it's more of a psychic or spiritual leap than it is a matter of just reproducing, you know, in time.
I think that's one of my favorites. Subject. It's the shift from massive procreation to co-creation, from self-reproduction to self-evolution. And I believe what started in the 60s with the women, the feminist movement and the environmental movement coming in together, we recognized the population problem. If we actually can double the population one more time, we're out. So there must be a signal going through the women, even beyond just cultural, to say my urge to reproduce is shifting to my urge to self-express. My urge to nurture the child is shifting to the urge to give expression to the self. And I've coined this phrase, you've probably heard me say it, is that there is a new life cycle for the women called regenopause. That when you get to be postmenopause and your body's not producing eggs, there's a great opportunity to produce yourself. Because if you have 5 to 10 children, you're not going to be having much time for the birth of the individual, the authentic feminine self. We haven't seen the authentic feminine self on this planet for thousands of years due to the structure of society. And I think what's happening as for reproductive rights is the beginning way of saying I'm responsible for my own body and how many children I have. But beyond that, I'm responsible for giving birth to my own essential self. And in the general cause, when you say yes to the birth of that self, and you say yes to that self-expression in the world, it activates your vitality. It activates, I mean, look at me, I'm 77. What is wrong with me? I should be, you know, a diet. I'm not dying, I'm evolving.
No, you're young.
So the creative impulse of anyone is ageless. And I am personally not chronologically specific. I'm looking at my partner Sydney, he's laughing. And I always tell him this. He says, I'm 83. I say, so what? You're not chronologically specific. So anyway, I feel that in the longer picture of things, that when a person identifies with their own essence, and when that person finds the essence is creative and wants to express it, that you tap into the vitality of the universal process of creation, and that as longevity increases, which it's going to do, and as the biological revolution kicks in, if it really does, to say we're going to have a really vastly extended lifespan, the whole purpose of postmenopausal and for men regenerative years is to fully express your divine self in the creation of yourself and the world. You can't do that at the age of 30 or 40. It takes a while to grow up. And I believe that the regenopausal women as a type of humanity are the missing link in our species from our current set of crises to the possible future in partnership with men who love them and will work with them. So instead of resenting the woman who is powerfully motivated, because she's not motivated by aggression and she's not motivated by dominance. She's motivated by love and co-creativity. And every woman I know who's a co-creative feminine yearns for partnership. And so the men are being called forward by the women.
You're looking forward to Mrs. Pelosi.
Mrs. Pelosi, yes, exactly. She is ready.
She's a mother.
A mother of five, a grandmother in her 60s. She's a perfect example. And Hillary, too.
Yeah.
When I saw during the president's speech, there was Nancy Pelosi standing right behind him. It was really great.
The first time I ever heard the first time I ever saw her as a candidate out, she was so fluent and spoke so well.
She's marvelous.
Yeah.
She's marvelous.
But
yeah.
She was asked, Nancy Pelosi was asked, did her family raise her to be political? And she said, no, they raised me to be holy.
Holy, oh,
yes. Back to a personal level, if your ego self is screaming at you constantly and you're having a string to me at something at work and you're blurring my day, practically what do you do? I think the essence is to get back to that quiet space and just try to get into it.
But
so how do you do that? When I'm screaming at you.
I think you've got to give yourself some sacred space.
Mm-hmm.
You need the sacred space. You need to develop what I call the inner sanctuary. And this is the way I did it. I put attention on those moments of grace, on those higher self intuitions, until I actually attracted my own higher self into my own essence by attention.
Okay. That last?
All right. Every one of us has fleeting moments of higher self-intuition, of periods of grace, but they usually pass quickly, and we don't focus on. What I did is I got up early in the morning from 6 to 9 every day for a month, and I'm a journal writer, so I'm very used to getting higher guidance. So I put my attention on the feeling of receiving that higher being. It's joyful, it's whole, it's peaceful. And the more I put my attention on just those fleeting moments, the more my egoic self was attracted to that higher self. And the egoic self finally said to me, why would we only be noticing this when writing in our journal? Why don't we keep our attention here?
Mm-hmm.
So I created the inner sanctuary, and gradually the egoic self asked the higher self to come in the whole way and take dominion. And I made the shift that I'm calling the birth of the universal human. And if you want to see it, it's my book, Immersion. And also, we have a whole course that is now on internet called Gateway to Conscious Evolution, where there are hundreds and hundreds of people working on this. If you look at evolve.org or barbaramarkshubbard.com, and oh, it's up there. Oh, thank you. And also, my movie, if you haven't seen it, is Humanity Ascending. And you can find that on barbaramarkshubbard.com, and it tells this story in 40 minutes. And if you want to show it to your friends and have little discussions about your own evolution, I certainly would invite you to do that. So I think we're just coming to time. It's been a great pleasure. I really love being with you all. Thank you.